You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
This is not your typical work podcast.
Sometimes you need to be empathetic. And then there are times that you ask for input, but you don't really give a shit.
Listen to the Ambie Award-nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
Stretch opportunity. What is this, yoga class? Get out of here.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're listening for the first time, this is a preview station for Kick-Ass Politics, where I put up a few sample episodes for you to check out. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like it, then I encourage you to go to our main program at Kick-Ass Politics and subscribe to the show. There are a lot more episodes there. Just search for Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes, or if you go to the information page for this episode on iTunes, there's a link right there to subscribe to the main show. Also, feel free to check out our webpage at kickasspolitics.com, where you'll find show notes, book recommendations, and all kinds of extras. I'm Ben Mathis, and I hope you enjoy this preview of Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is sponsored by Gold Medal Wine Club. Since 1992, they've been America's leading independent wine club. And right now, if you go to the show site at kickasspolitics.com and click on our special link on the sponsor page, Gold Medal Wine Club will give you up to 45% off wines rated 90 points and up. Plus, they'll even throw in free shipping. For all your wine desires, Gold Medal Wine Club. Hi, folks. I'm really excited today because I'm going to be talking with one of my favorite journalists, a woman I really admire. If you watch Fox News, you've seen her reporting from the Pentagon probably just about every day. I'm, of course, talking about Fox News national security correspondent Jennifer Griffin. For the past 7 years, Jennifer has reported on national security for Fox, and before that, she was based in Jerusalem, where she served as Fox News Middle East correspondent. In recent years, just some of the stories she's reported on include the Edward Snowden NSA leaks, the U.S. consulate attack in Benghazi, Libya, the 2004 tsunami in Phuket, and Operation Enduring Freedom. Before joining Fox News in 1999, Jennifer Griffin reported around the world for the Associated Press, National Public Radio, and U.S. News and World Report. Jennifer began her career as a journalist covering the anti-apartheid movement for the Sowetan, which was the only black-owned newspaper in South Africa at the time. On a personal note, Jennifer Griffin is a survivor of stage 3 breast cancer, and she's married to New York Times reporter Greg Meyer, with whom she co-authored a book called This Burning Land: Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. I'll talk to Jennifer Griffin about her and her husband's experiences in the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and her early years covering the fall of apartheid and the release of Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And she'll also tell me about the transition from reporting in some of the most dangerous places in the world to being a working mom and Fox Pentagon correspondent, and how that experience led to a surprising bond with our troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. She'll reveal the scariest moment in her life, and she'll tell me which national security concerns are the ones that keep her up at night. So don't go anywhere. I'll have all that and more with Fox News Jennifer Griffin on today's podcast.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
So I'm here with Fox News correspondent Jennifer Griffin. Jennifer, is there anywhere in the world that you haven't been? You have covered Gaza, you've covered Iraq, you've covered Libya, Phuket in the aftermath of the tsunami,
You battled stage 3 breast cancer, and then as soon as you were done with your treatment, you hopped a plane to Afghanistan. When you look back at those experiences, what is the scaredest that you have ever been in your life?
Wow. You know, it's funny. We were just on a panel with Sal Junta, Staff Sergeant Sal Junta, who's a right. Medal of Honor recipient. And we were talking about those moments in the Korangal Valley, Afghanistan, 2007, when he came under this incredible fire and ambush and what was going through his mind, whether he was fearful going into combat. And I think it's when you look back on experiences that you think, and particularly now that my children are getting older and I think that they are going to start going out and having their own adventures in the world. When I look back at some of the things I did in my 20s and places that I went, and I think of my children doing that, that's when I get scared.
Yeah.
I've been through a lot of experiences, as you mentioned. I met my husband in South Africa when I was 20 years old. I left college. I was at Harvard at the time, and I took a year off, and it was the end of apartheid, and Mandela was still in prison. And we met in Soweto. I was working for the only black newspaper in the country. At that time, there was still apartheid. And we met in Soweto and began this incredible journey and this incredible life together. And one of the first assignments that he had where we were going to be separated, he was sent to Somalia, to Mogadishu, to cover. He was working for the Associated Press at the time and AP. And, you know, again, I was a young, hot-headed, hot-blooded 20-year-old wow. who was ready to conquer the world. And he said, well, I'm heading to Somalia, Mogadishu, full-on famine. It was before the Marines arrived. We all remember Black Hawk mm-hmm. Down and what happened there. But this was early, and people were dying. And I was so mad because he was leaving me behind in South Africa, and I had just graduated from college, and my dad had given me some money to it was supposed to set me up as a freelance journalist, and it was supposed to last a year. And at that time, this was the early 90s, there wasn't email, there weren't cell phones. You couldn't just
right.
the information flow in my lifetime, the way it's changed. So I bought a ticket without telling Greg, my husband, that I was going to show up in Mogadishu, which at the time there were no you know, international air flights. There was a full-on war raging in the capital. But I had it in my mind that, well, he's going there, I'm going there. And I bought a one-way ticket. I used all the money my dad had given me for graduation. I bought a one-way ticket to Kenya, went to the airport there, a small little airport where all the flights for safaris would take off. And there were some aid flights, UNICEF flights heading into Mogadishu. And you had to be an accredited journalist to get on those flights. And I wasn't accredited to anything. I didn't even have a string yet. But I knew no fear at that point because I was too young to know fear.
Now, and did your parents know that you were doing this, or did you keep that to yourself till afterwards?
I'm not sure I told them, but I think I told them I was going to Kenya, and they thought, oh, isn't that great, a safari?
Yeah.
But I don't think I knew what I was getting myself into. I mean, I was just, it was a big wide world at that moment, and I thought I was being left behind. And so I went to this airport, and on one end of the airport, the UNICEF flights were taking off, but I couldn't get on those flights because I wasn't a journalist. And on the other end of the airport were the cot dealers, the drug dealers who flew the cot into Mogadishu, and you could pay your weight in cot. So the equivalent of cot, you could play your weight, and they would fly you into Mogadishu. And so I was negotiating to do that, and someone from UNICEF saw me negotiating, and they said, "I think you better come with me." And they gave me we flew in. It was a corkscrew landing in the capital because there was so much shooting taking place. We landed. I found Greg, who again was working for the AP and was staying at the UNICEF house. And at that point, I picked up my pen. I called some newspapers and said, I'm here. There were no other journalists. There were a couple of wire reporters there. And that was how I got started. And when I look back, a few weeks ago, we had a brunch with some some members of the military who had been in Mogadishu and had been in Somalia during the famine and after around the time of Black Hawk Down. And we were talking about those days, and we were talking about a place called Baidoa, which I never thought I would go to Baidoa. I never thought I'd talk to anyone who'd been to Baidoa afterwards. But that's where a lot of people, the famine was hitting hardest. And this Marine special operator, he said, oh, yeah, I was out in Baidoa at that time. I said, what? We didn't have the military there. What's been fascinating at the Pentagon is I have gotten to meet over the years so many people in the military and in the special operations community, particularly, who have been in places that and been deployed to places that my husband Greg and I were working as journalists over those 20 years overseas, that it's been a nice place to land coming back to the U.S. to be at the Pentagon, where all these years of experience have given – it's a great sense of camaraderie to meet the people in the military who were doing similar work in places where we as journalists used to deploy. And you asked me – that was a long-winded answer
well,
to when was I fearful? When was I last scared? When I think back to being in Somalia in those days, This was pre-Daniel Pearl, before journalists started being a target – I think I would really have to say that some of the things I did in those years before journalists became kidnapping targets and the targets of beheadings, we went to extraordinary places where it was very dangerous, perhaps, but we always felt a little bit protected because of our pens, and we were needed by the people we were talking to. And so we interviewed some of the most dangerous characters of the last 20 years, but we didn't feel like we would be a target. That's changed now, and that's really the crucial – I don't know what it's going to mean in terms of the coverage of foreign news, but it has really had a chilling effect on our ability as journalists to get the story out of what it is like in these places where we are sending people to war, where we are debating our national security interests. And I'm very concerned about where we have ended up now that journalists are no longer protected and going into war zones.
Well, yeah, it definitely seems that all bets are off. Is that part of the reason, also just as a wife and a mother, that you feel a lot more comfortable being in Washington at this point? I mean, what was that decision like?
That
it must
decision,
have been a radical change for you.
Interestingly enough, Ben, that decision came after one of my colleagues was kidnapped in Gaza. Steve Sintani and Olaf Wig were working for Fox at the time in the summer of 2006 when the war between Israel and Hezbollah broke out in on the border with Lebanon. They were down in Gaza at that time, and as the war was ending in Lebanon, Steve and Olaf were picked up by a jihadist group down in Gaza. And that was also a game changer for us as a news organization, and for me as a journalist who had covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the prior 7 years. We had covered the Intifada. It had been very dangerous. There had been suicide bombings and military movements into the West Bank and Gaza. But that was different because, again, journalists were being targeted. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for me as a mother. I had given birth to two daughters in Jerusalem. They had been born in Israel during the Intifada. I was wearing a flak jacket when I was pregnant covering suicide bombings. But it changed as soon as they started targeting journalists, and that you felt like that protection, if you will, if we were ever really protected, sometimes it was just psychologically we felt that we were protected. Yeah. When my colleagues were kidnapped, that's when I felt that the equation had changed and it was time to come home, to bring those kids home. The kids were probably 4 and 6 at the time, and it just felt like the right thing to do. But I missed it. I will be honest. My husband and I, because we both have been journalists a long time, we were so depressed when we moved back to D.C. It took several years to come out of that feeling that we were just not where we should be, which was in the field. And it's taken until probably now for me to feel that the journalism and the reporting that we do from Washington matters in the way that it felt like it really mattered when we were in the field. But just to add, I think it also gives me an insight and a sense of camaraderie with the military members that I cover who have deployed to some of these hot zones and had to come home. Some of those issues of reintegration, some of the issues of reintegration are very similar, and I think it gives me an insight and empathy into what they go through when they come back from war, because of having gone through some of that. That feeling of not quite fitting in, or feeling like I should be somewhere else, and then I would say on top of that, when I went through my breast cancer battle, that was a year that is a trauma of sorts that any survivor of cancer will tell you that you're never quite the same afterwards. But yet there are many of us surviving. Many people are surviving cancer, just as many people survive wars. But some of the psychological effects of that, I think it allows me to relate to many of our wounded warriors who are coming home changed after combat.
Yeah, you've certainly seen a lot. You know, I think in the old days in journalism, I think they would probably refer to you as one tough broad. What for you?
You know what my kids used to call me? They used to call me Mommy Tsunami, because I would come in, come out.
Cute.
And that was after I went to Asia to cover the tsunami years ago. But that
wasn't so adorable then.
That nickname stuck.
I love that. Well, what is your secret to mental toughness in the face of adversity? If anyone knows.
I don't know if I'm that tough.
Can know.
You know what? I cry a lot.
Yeah.
I'm actually very emotional, and I probably cry too much when I'm telling stories, but I think telling stories is probably my way of coping with my own experiences, as well as the collective experience that we as a nation have gone through in this incredible more than decade-long fight against terrorism. I think that telling other people's stories has been very therapeutic for me in terms of my own wounds, psychological wounds from the last 20 years of covering conflict and situations that, I mean, the idea that we're back in Iraq, you know, fighting ISIS, it's very debilitating for, I see it amongst the those in the Pentagon who are still serving, who lived through those wars. I mean, we all as a nation are going through a kind of, we're going to have to figure out how to get each other through this period. And it is going to probably be through storytelling, both our own and listening to the stories of those who have served in the last 12, 13 years, because this has been a trauma. It's been a trauma for the nation ever since 9/11. I think it's probably one of the reasons that you're starting to hear from members of some of these secret teams who were involved in the Bin Laden mission and other. I think some of those folks feel like the nation needs to hear their stories as a way to heal. So I think storytelling is probably the way I deal with it. But I would be lying if I didn't say that it's had an effect on me and my family. It has.
I'm curious, because what you were just saying there, do you find that it's somewhat disheartening when we find ourselves fighting the same wars over again? Do you feel that we're not moving forward?
Well, sometimes it feels like Groundhog Day, and I think we're at an inflection point right now where we do all have to take stock of what we thought were going to be the answers to how to fight against this. I mean, let's face it, we are in a period of historic change post-Cold War, where Islamic radicalism is taking advantage of these shifting shifting alliances, shifting historic trends. I mean, things that we are going to have to step back and be smarter than the enemy. We are smarter than the enemy. And, you know, I've found what's really therapeutic right now is I've been watching a lot of documentaries. Ken Burns just did The Roosevelts, which was amazing.
That was fantastic. A
fantastic 7-part series. The whole nation should watch that series, because if you think that what we're going through right now is the worst that this nation has ever seen, think again. Go back to what FDR and what Teddy Roosevelt were facing, and go back to the period of economic turmoil, the Depression, and the world wars that emanated from that during that time period, and you'll realize that good leadership, the right person at the right moment, leading this nation and using all of the strengths of this incredible country. We don't need to be despondent, but it is easy right now, I think, for those of us who have been following these wars as closely as we have for the last more than decade to feel a bit despondent. But I think we really need to study our history and realize that we have been through as much, if not worse.
Well, you're absolutely right, Jennifer. I think every generation tends to think that they're living in the most dire of times and project this Armageddon mentality onto current events. But, you know, but we all know the truth is there's nothing new under the sun. Everything my generation is experiencing pales in comparison to what my grandfather and the greatest generation faced. And I'm also glad that you pointed out Ken Burns' documentary on the Roosevelts, because I want to highly recommend that to all the listeners. We're going to take a short break, and then I'll be back in a minute to talk more with Fox News national security correspondent Jennifer Griffin. So stay tuned for more. This portion of the podcast is sponsored by Fiverr. That's F-I-V-E-R-R. Now, folks, you've heard me rave about Fiverr before. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100,000 categories all offered for a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, transcription, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can possibly imagine, all offered at a base price of just $5. In fact, you know the announcer who does our intro to Kick-Ass Politics? I found him on Fiverr, a professional radio announcer to do our intro for just $5. And right now, when you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. If you like Kick-Ass Politics and you want to keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. And I'm back with Fox News Pentagon correspondent Jennifer Griffin. You covered the Middle East and specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for a good long while, for many years. You and your husband actually wrote a book called This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. What are some of those lessons?
Well, I think that one of the main lessons is that what we noticed in Washington is that after we arrived in Israel in 1999, and a year later, the Intifada began, and the Second Intifada, as it's known, and that's when the suicide bombings began, and it was a very traumatic time. Israel retook territory in the West Bank that it had handed back to the Palestinians. The Oslo Peace Accords were essentially ripped up. It was a very traumatic time. It was when the large wall that, you know, snakes down the back of the follows basically the Green Line in Israel and divides the Palestinians from the Israelis was built. That wall is seen as a symbol of oppression and segregation and has been the subject. But we lived through how the reason that that wall was built, which was that the daily suicide bombings in Israel, unless you've lived through that, now we've all come to understand in a post 9/11 world, we see, we take for granted that suicide bombings are kind of what this current war is all about. And you see it in Iraq and elsewhere, and we've gotten numb to it. But at that time, Israel was facing this kind of alone, and it was really a stunning tactic that really so you kind of have to have lived through that to understand why Israel built that wall. So one of the lessons that I think we learned is that both the Israeli and Palestinian populations, the ones that were willing to maybe take a chance on peace during the Oslo period, that they had been fundamentally changed by those suicide bombings and the breach of faith on the part of the Israelis, that they reneged on their part of certain agreements and retook territory and encircled cities with their military in the Palestinian areas, divided up Palestinian areas in a way that people couldn't get to their jobs, they could lost their livelihood. That fundamental change on both sides, Hamas came to power and actually was elected into power while we were there, that really changed the equation of what it was going to take in terms of a Israeli-Palestinian settlement for a peace agreement. And yet Washington stayed very much behind and didn't understand. And so every time I see a new Secretary of State come in and dust off the same old Camp David accords that were negotiated by Clinton, President Clinton, and were rejected by Yasser Arafat, and I just think there's a degree of naivete as to where these two people are and what it will take. I mean, unfortunately, at the end of those 7.5 years of fighting, the Israelis pretty much dominated and won, if you will, if you want to use that term. And to then act like you can sort of dust off old agreements from the 90s and that the Israelis will just say, oh, okay, sure, we didn't go through that last 10 years. And I mean, the lack of trust right now between the Israelis and Palestinians is so, so stunning that I just think there is a naive understanding at the State Department at times about what is needed there. And so we just painted a portrait. Again, we didn't try to take sides. Each chapter kind of rotates between, you know, my husband was working for the New York Times at that time and I was working for Fox News. Everyone says, oh, how did you get along in those days? And
James Carville and Mary Madeline.
Well, right. But we actually really believe in old school journalism, tell both sides of the story. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of covering Israel and the Palestinians in those days is that you could cross back and forth across the front lines, really try to explain each side's point of view. And that's what we try to do in the book. Without being Pollyannish, we really explain how the landscape and the people changed during that last decade. And I think it's really something every politician in Washington should read to understand where the Israelis and Palestinians are right now and stop trying to sort of shove an agreement down their throat that they have been set back many, many decades as a result of that intifada.
Well, you talk about there being a big change in the amount of trust between the Palestinians and Israelis. What is your perception as someone who's in the Pentagon and day-to-day in Washington of the relationship between the administration and Israel and that trust?
Well, it's at an all-time low, which is very unfortunate on a political level. And there's plenty of blame to go around on both sides, on the U.S. side and on the Israeli side. It's interesting. I was reading Leon Panetta's memoir on the plane ride out here, and it's an important book, and it has some interesting details about the relationship between Israel, the intelligence relationship between when he was director of CIA and Meir Dagan, who was quite a legendary head of the Mossad, and that intelligence relationship, I think, still is very close. I think the military relationship is very close, but I think politically we've never been further apart.
For a moment, I just want to go way back. You were a reporter in South Africa for, I believe it was the only black newspaper.
It was at the time.
In South Africa at the time, during apartheid. You were there for the release of Mandela and the end of apartheid. What was that like as someone who was there on the ground for this amazing moment in history? And in your estimation, what was it about Mandela that separated him from other men?
It's so interesting. And I would step back, having thought about this many times over the last few decades as we've encountered other places in transition, historic transitions, convulsed by war or inequity. And what was it about Mandela that made him so special? He truly is one of the greatest figures in history that I've had the ability to meet. But it wasn't just him. He had a partner on the other side. I don't think enough credit goes to F.W. de Klerk, because what was so special about that time in South Africa is that there was real leadership. There was leadership that we have seen lacking almost everywhere in the world that I've lived since then. Leadership where, yes, there were historic forces at play and apartheid was probably crumbling, ending on its own, but it took the leadership of these two giants who really went against, I mean, Mandela, the quality in him that really is lacking now in many of our leaders was the ability to forgive. I mean, he truly, the idea that you could be in prison for 27 years on an island breaking rocks for much of that time, the indignation, the what he went through, and the idea that some of his first gestures when he came out of prison were to reconcile and not to add to the hate. And I mean, I love the movie Invictus because that is just, that is, those are the moments I remember of Mandela, of bringing everyone together, whites and blacks. There was not a sense that he was just, he had that incredible quality. De Klerk took a great risk and went against his own people, knowing that the gig was up. We did not see that when we lived in Israel with someone like a Yasser Arafat. The thing that was lacking in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and elsewhere when we were living in Pakistan and covering Afghanistan in the early 90s when the Taliban were being formed, what was missing in all of those conflicts or places going through historic transitions was the sense of leadership, ethical leadership, and also the absence of religious figures. I also give Desmond Tutu a huge amount of credit. You had religious leaders who were preaching reconciliation, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that went into effect after Mandela was released and was elected president finally after years of apartheid. That prevented an all-out civil war. I mean, when we were living there, it was still touch and go whether there was going to be a massive civil war. They avoided that kind of bloodshed that everywhere else we've lived, the stubborn refusal to forgive and the lack of leaders, whether it was Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan or Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan or what we've seen on both sides of the aisle in Washington. There have not been the kind of leaders in Russia. We lived at the end of the Yeltsin era in Russia at the end of the Cold War, watching Yeltsin and then Putin come to power. And in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there were not religious leaders on all sides of that conflict who were willing to bring people together and truly reconcile. And that's what's so disappointing about the modern Middle East right now, the absence of leadership and religious ethical leadership as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I'll just wrap up with one last question here. When you look at the global security landscape today, if you could pick one region or scenario that keeps you up at night, what would that be?
Well, the problem is there's not just one region. It used to be we were in a kind of bipolar world where you could look at one area and that would be the focus. I think what disturbs me at the Pentagon is seeing that there are – it is as though – I mean, using a cancer analogy, the threat has metastasized and it is spread all over the world. And I think that's what bothers me, is that – we as a nation could muster the resources to fight one, maybe two enemies. In fact, that's how the Pentagon budget used to be built, to fight 2.5 wars. Now you have 10 wars going on simultaneously, and it's not just in the Middle East. It's not just in North Africa. It's Ebola. It's North Korea. Are we missing opportunities to make peace in places because we're so stretched in the way we're fighting? That's what worries me. And then while all this is happening, you've got the rise of Putin again in Europe. You've got there are so many threats right now. And then we used to have al-Qaeda kind of cornered in Afghanistan, Pakistan. Now, again, to use the cancer analogy, it's metastasized. And so I think that's what worries me most, is how do we not run ourselves into the ground the way the Soviet Union did, by stretching ourselves too thin and not being strategic in the way we fight? That's what worries me most, is that we're exhausted and we're making decisions based on you know, in an exhausted state, and I'm concerned that we're going to run through our precious resources, whether they're soldiers and troops, or whether it's our money, our limited resources. We have to step back and be strategic about how we fight.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer Griffin, for joining me. I very much appreciate it. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Jennifer Griffin of Fox News, and I want to thank Jennifer again for coming on the podcast. She is such a delight.
If you enjoyed today's episode, then I think you'd really enjoy a book called This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict by today's guest, Fox News correspondent Jennifer Griffin, and her husband, New York Times reporter Greg Meyer. And right now, you can download the audio version of this book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be This Burning Land by my guests Jennifer Griffin and Greg Meyer, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you get fresh episodes as soon as they're available. And leave us a review on iTunes. That actually helps us a great deal. And if you like what we're doing here at Kick-Ass Politics, then please show your support for the show and make a donation by going to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. I appreciate your encouragement and support. On the next podcast, I was really inspired by my chat with Jennifer Griffin about Nelson Mandela. And just a couple of weeks ago, it was actually the one-year anniversary of Nelson Mandela's funeral. So I've decided to do an episode on some of the leadership lessons from Nelson Mandela. I think that these are lessons that are very relevant to the current racial situation in America. And frankly, I think some of the so-called leaders in the African-American community, Al Sharpton, could learn an awful lot from Nelson Mandela about healing and bringing people together instead of stoking the flames and dividing people. I had the great privilege of meeting Mandela a couple of times in his later years, and he was really one of the most extraordinary men of the 20th century. So I'm definitely looking forward to exploring his legacy on the next podcast. Until then, I'm Ben Mathis, and thank you for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.